This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Based on the third of Parsha Shmini, which tells us the really colorful story, not a little tragic, of the bringing up of the Oren to Ir David, to the city of David, where David felt it needed to be. And the Oren was placed on a wagon, which was drawn by animals, and a great multitude of people, led by David himself, danced around this wagon and led it up, and bringing korbanos every few paces. It must have been an amazing procession. At one particular point, the animals lost their step, and the wagon tilted, and the Oren was about to slide off. At which point Uzzah put out his hand to protect the Oren, to stop the Oren from sliding off. An absolutely natural and spontaneous reflex action. Just as people might be standing around somebody doing hagbone, and with a person stumbles and loses his grip a little bit, everybody automatically jumps forward to try and support the saboteur and catch it and place it to fall. Absolutely natural and normal. But he died for that. Because Hashem cried out to Uzzah, the Rebbeinu Shalom was angry with Uzzah and struck him dead on the spot. Why? What did he do wrong? So Mr. Tebe brought the Chazal that we know that Aaron may say it myself, but when the Aaron was being carried, it carried those who were carrying it. If that's no location, it can't look after itself. An Aaron which can support those who carry it can't support itself. And Jesus should have realized that and left Aaron alone. He should have known that Aaron would not fall. What does that mean, that Uzzah forgot? Does it mean that Uzzah never learned that piece of Tanakh, that Uzzah didn't know that medrash? That Uzzah didn't know that tradition, that the ark supported those who carried it? That the ark had within it the power of self-support? Does it mean that Uzzah learned it when he was a traitor and he subsequently forgot? Does it mean he knew it? What would have happened if he asked Uzzah right afterwards? And if Uzzah, but don't you know, the ark can support himself, what would he say? Sure I know, but you know, the spirit of the moment, you don't think of those things. You react. And all I saw was the arm falling and I put my hand out to support it. Anybody would have done that. And yet it's killed. My conclusion with Mr. Kirby built up around this observation is that we are responsible not only for our conscious action, but also for our reflex action. Even for the things we do intuitively, instinctively, in a reflex sort of manner, we're responsible for that too. Not just because Uzzah died. Uzzah might have died just because he touched the Oren. And no matter whether you touch because of reflex or not, if you touch high voltage electricity without insulation, it makes a difference whether you're touching it for reflex or you're touching it out of conscious decision, you die. But the person says, Hashem cried for Uzzah. Hashem was angry with Uzzah. Angry for a reflex action, which when we look at and try and analyze looks completely normal, an action that any of that would have taken. Yes, angry because of his reflex and because he didn't analyze it in terms of that chazal. I want to explore that concept a little further. Because we have another situation in the Sedra of a reflex action which Hashem wasn't too happy with. And in this case, it is with none other than Moshe Rabbeinu himself. The Torah says, the Eis Seir HaChatos Doresh Doresh Moshe. After the death of the two sons of Aaron, Moshe sought the goat which was brought for the Korban Chatas. Mari Doresh Barash, what does it mean he sought, using two words, Doresh Barash, he sought and sought again, what was he seeking? Where is Drishas? He had two questions on the remaining children, on Aaron and his two, remaining two sons. On Aaron, he said to them, Im shechatitem lama liachate? If you shechted the animal, why have you not eaten it? You're the crowning, you have to eat it. And if you weren't ready to eat it, lama shechatitem? Why did you shecht the animal? Miyad vayikzu ta'yolozo v'alaytana ena, she got angry with the lozo in the tana. Akivan shekoat, this alma mimenu halokha. And as a result of his anger, he forgot the halokha. The halokha is, she'einim osu lecho b'kodshim. If an einim, somebody who has just lost a close relative, a kohen has just lost a close relative, and it's the day of the nisa, Kriya is not yet taking place, it's about to take place. The Yom HaKriya is not permitted to eat in the Kodshim. Make sure you forget such a simple halakha. Make sure you forget. What was he angry about? It appears to him just that he was angry that they didn't eat the korban. And he didn't know the halakha that Maimon isn't allowed to eat the korban. But the Chaim Shmuel Levit points out that can't be, because it says that he forgot the halakha after he got angry. That means before he got angry, he knew the halakha. So he knew an omen isn't allowed to eat. If he knew that an omen isn't allowed to eat, then what was he getting angry with him for? But the Chaim HaKadosh also asks that question, and he says that what they were getting angry with him for was, as Chazal say, that they passed him in his presence. They should have asked him the Shaila. They shouldn't have passed him themselves. That's what he got angry. Since he got angry, he then forgot the halacha altogether. So that had they asked him, he would have given the wrong answer afterwards. But that means his anger was absolutely justified. The Chaim Shmuel Levit is a beautiful shmuz in another place on the whole question of Pesach Bifnei Rabbe, of Paschal and Shaila in the presence of one's Rebbe, and how that's not just got to do with a covered harav. That's not the reason that you're not allowed to do that is not just because it's not covered to do it. He goes through the whole thing, but it doesn't help. He brings beautiful chazal, with clear proof that the Gemara tells one story where a young man passed in the halacha in front of his robe, and the Tana said, this young man is not going to live out to the year. By the end of the year, he's going to be dead. And he died. Chassid Chaim Shmuel Levit said, why didn't he make him? It's a murderer. You know he's going to die because he's insulted you, so forgive him, and he'll live. How can you just stand there and make a statement he's going to die within a year and keep quiet? Chassid Chaim Shmuel Levit, you see that he has no right, and it wouldn't help forgiving. If it was only a matter of the rebbe's covered, the rebbe could be mechel. Harav shemochal ha-kavodah, kavodah mochel. The rebbe's entitled to be mechel when he's covered. So I don't mind, I have no objection. And if he would have done that, you see from this that wouldn't have helped. He's saying, no matter what I do, this young man is going to die within a year because he's passed in the halakha in front of his rebbe. So the Chaim Shmuel Levit, that's not because he's insulted the rebbe, that's because he has about turned the whole dynamics of Torah. The whole dynamics of Torah is from the previous generation to the younger generation. And he's turned it around. And he's teaching the older generation their business. That makes them, and that undermines the very foundations of everything the Torah is built on. That turns the Torah into a secular science, where the new generation goes further than the old generation, where the new generation teaches the old generation. That's turning Torah into something secular. The essence of Torah is the old generation teaches the young generation. There's Messias, there's Kabbalah, things are handed down. And for a young man to draw a conclusion without checking up with his elders shows that he doesn't understand the dynamics. And for that there's no Mechilim. None of you can help. He has overturned Torah. He's not insulted an individual. And therefore, says the Chaim Shmuel Levit, Moshe was quite right to get angry. You've gone against our principles of Torah. Here I'm standing, and you passing in halachas. Well, I am the source of your Torah. So his anger was justified anger. Nevertheless, he suffers. He forgets the halacha. Moshe Rabbeinu is a terrible thing. Forget the halacha. Not to know the deen. To have known something and have forgotten it. The Rebbe's Kula Shecheach, the Rebbe Echad, Mitalmidus, even Mitzayah, the Nafshu. It's a capital offense. To forget something you knew. Forget a piece of Torah. The people to whom Torah really means something, it's a frightful thing. It's written in the Medrash that on three occasions this happened. that Moshe Rabbeinu got angry, and he forgot the halakha as a result of the anger. It's very difficult for us to understand on Moshe Rabbeinu's level what kind of wrong he did here. What should he have done? Shouldn't he have gotten angry? Of course, he was justified in getting angry. But he forgot the halakha. Is he being criticized? Isn't he being criticized? It appears that on the surface that Chazal is expressing a word of criticism. That Moshe Rabbeinu, even then, although the anger was justified, the price he had to pay for that anger was too high. And had he been correctly attuned on his level, which is beyond anything we're able to contemplate and to imagine in our mind, but still Chazal tell us that because we need to learn from it. Had he been correctly attuned, he would have not got angry, although he was justified. So here are two cases with Isaac. He was justified in trying to protect the Aaron. He wasn't doing it for self-glory. He wasn't doing it in order to promote himself. He wasn't doing it for any ulterior motive. He was doing it for one motive only, to save the Aaron from falling. That's all. A feeling, a reaction, and a reflex which seems to be good and fine in every way is punished for it with death. Moshe Rabbeinu, a moment of anger, justified anger, kosher anger, punished with something which is like death. Really mischayev benafsh, against the halacha. A part of him is gone. A part of him is died. A piece of his knowledge is gone. Very severe consequences for two responses, almost reflex actions. Each one of them absolutely l'shem shemayim. Each one of them with the best of good intention. And yet both of them dealt with so terribly harshly. Again, we see the concept that Mr. Kirby developed this morning, that we are held responsible not only for our conscious actions and decisions, but that we are held responsible also for our reflex actions, which is a difficult thing to understand. We're held responsible for reflex actions? But if a reflex action, we do something wrong? There is such a concept in halacha also, and the Gemara discusses the degree of culpability attached to a man who causes damage in his sleep. He stretches in his sleep and knocks over the precious vase. These things are discussed in our local too. And it seems to reinforce this principle that we are responsible for things that we do subconsciously. But I would like to explore that principle a little bit. Why are we responsible for things that we do subconsciously? How can we control our subconscious? How can we control our reflexes? How can we find ourselves in a situation where we don't act incorrectly on a reflex basis? There's another amazing thing about this Medrash, this Moshe Rabbeinu. This one gets angry when Chochmah goes. One forgets. So what do you think one forgets? One forgets something that one learned a long time ago. One forgets something very subtle. But when did Moshe Rabbeinu last know this halacha, that an Omer is not allowed to eat the korban? When was the last time he knew it? He must have known it when he saw them not eating. Because it was learned that the reason he got angry with them was not because because he felt that an Aaron should eat. That's not the reason. Because then he would have forgotten halacha before he got angry. So it's clear from the Medrash, if you learn the Medrash carefully, it's clear that the moment at which he forgot the halacha, that an Aaron is not allowed to eat the korban, is the moment he got angry. I mean, the moment before he got angry, he knew the halacha. And that's why the Erachayim HaKodesh says what he got angry about was not the question of an Aaron eating or not eating. That wasn't the question. He got angry because they're passing the halacha in his presence. That's why he got angry. But did he know the halacha? Of course he knew the halacha. That means that the anger causes him to forget the halacha which he knew a fraction of a second ago. Now how does one understand that? That's difficult to understand. That you can forget something good. You heard it a long time, you've forgotten it. You heard it last week, you've forgotten it. One can understand such a thing. But a Moshe Rabbeinu who knows halacha with such clarity can know it 1 second, and a second later it's gone. through an act of chaos, through a moment of anger. How does the anger affect a reflex action, a good reflex action? He was entitled to be angry, and yet he loses a halacha which he knew a moment ago. We think that forgetfulness is something which happens slowly. We think that we got out of the shoe in the night and we think, well, we more or less remember it. Tomorrow we remember it a little bit less, and in a week's time we remember it a little bit less, and in 6 months' time we've totally forgotten it. It's a slow deterioration of character. Isn't there like that? Sometimes memory lapses, sometimes forgetting. In this context, we'll understand it more clearly a little bit later. Sometimes a loss of memory, sometimes forgetting. A halacha, forgetting, Torah, is something which happens instantaneously. You can pinpoint the moment at which you knew it 1 second and you lost it a second later. Gone. In the ladies' shiur this morning, we examined a concept which is closely related to the problems we're having here. Eliyahu HaNavi gets to the end of his lifetime. In the second chapter of Melachim Beis, Hashem is the removal of Eliyahu HaNavi from this world is described. Eliyahu first of all tells his kindly Elisha that he's going to be taken away. And then, Vayikshu v'nei ha-Nevi'im asher b'iricho el Elisha, the other Talmudim of the prophets, Eliyahu's other colleagues in Talmudim, approach Elisha in Yericho, Vayomru elav and they said to him, Hayodata ki hayom Hashem lekeat es adinecho mi'ayu eshecha. Do you know that today Eliyahu is going to be taken away from you? Your master Eliyahu, your Rebbe Eliyahu is going to be taken away from you? He says, yes, I know. Keep quiet, there's no reason to there's no need to discuss it. How did they know? How did the other Talmudim know that Eliyahu was going to be taken that day? They knew the Nevi'im. They were Nevi'im as well, they were prophets too, and they knew the prophecy that Eliyahu was going to be taken away from you. Why do they call Eliyahu your Rebbe? Why don't they call him our Rebbe? Says Rashi, Melamed Shayushkurim to Eliyahu, because they were as great as Eliyahu. So look who you're dealing with. You're dealing with a group of Nevi'im, headed by Eliyahu. The youngest, the smallest among them is Elisha, who will be Eliyahu's follower, who will be Eliyahu's successor. And a whole group of other Talmudim who are as great as Eliyahu. They're never mentioned by name, we don't know much about them. But they are as great in prophecy as Eliyahu HaNavi himself. The greatest of all prophets. How is it? The Tanakh only tells us things which apply, which are important for us to know throughout the generations. The Tanakh does not recount all of history. And anything which is not relevant to future generations, the Tanakh doesn't tell us. That doesn't mean that there weren't many, many Nevi'im and prophets who we never hear about, because they're not relevant to us today. And this is an example of such Nevi'im, of the statue of Eliyahu, never mind Elisha. At the statue of Eliyahu, they looked upon Elisha as the most junior of their group. Later on, the storm comes and Eliyahu is taken away in this fiery chariot. And Elisha picks up the cloak of Eliyahu and cries over it. And the other Talmudim of the prophets in Yericho saw the scene from opposite. And they said, we can see that the spirit of Eliyahu has rested upon Elisha. We can see that he's the successor. And they came, they were senior, but they realized that Elisha is the successor. And they come and submit themselves to him and bow down. And what's the first suggestion they make to the new leader, to the new prophet Elisha? We have at our disposal 50 strong men. Let them go and search for Eliyahu. Then the soul Riach Hashem v'yashlichehu ba'achad ha'orim v'ba'achad ha'geyus. Maybe a spirit of Hashem lifted him up, as we in fact saw it did, but maybe it dropped him somewhere in a mountain or in a valley. Let's go and see, he might be alive. He's waiting for us somewhere. Let's send out a search party. We can't just sit here and assume that he's gone to heaven. We didn't see him go to heaven. We send him there. Maybe he's dropped somewhere. Vayomer, and Elisha says, "Lo tishlochu, you shall not send him." Ask Rashi. Efshar omer shomu v'hayodose ki hayin Hashem l'keach ez adinecho v'achshav ne'ele mehem hefani? Is it possible that yesterday they said, last night they said to Elisha, "Do you know that your mouth is going to be taken away from you tomorrow?" Where did they think he was going to be taken? To the top of Table Mountain? Is that what they thought? They knew he was going to Shemayim, they knew Hashem was taking him. And today those same people, having seen the prophecy fulfilled, come back to Elisha and say, "Let's send up a search party. Maybe he's on the Drakensberg somewhere, maybe he's on Table Mountain. How can we just assume he's gone?" But you were the ones who knew the Levim that he was going to go. Why are you suggesting sending out a search party? You know what, you were Levim, greater than I, you were as great as Elio, and you knew what happened to him. Answers Rashi, Malamed, it teaches us that Shemayim Shemignaz Elio, from the time that Elio was removed, Olcho v'nistalko Riach HaKodesh min HaNevim, Riach HaKodesh went and removed itself from the prophets, the Shuvlos of Riach HaKodesh Meribah the Yisrael, and never again was there so much Riach HaKodesh available to Israel. Yes, the Yechidim individuals had it, Elisha had it, but they ceased to be prophets. And that's how they perceived that Elisha still had it. They realized they didn't and Elisha did, therefore Elisha was the successor of Elio. That altogether is an interesting concept, how Elio was responsible not only for his own prophecy, but for the prophecy of his whole group. But these others have made good, so they're no longer Nevi'im. That means they no longer have access to Nevi'im. But what about the Nevuah they knew yesterday, the Nevuah they had last night? Have they forgotten that? Doesn't say that they became forgetful. Just says they know more prophecy. But to remember yesterday's prophecy, is that so difficult? Last night you knew that Hashem was going to take Elio away. Today there's no more prophecy, fine. So you can't see with eyes of prophecy where he is. But you don't need to see with eyes of prophecy, because last night you knew where he was going to be today. What happened to that knowledge that you had last night? And so here once again we see a sudden loss of knowledge. Three cases we see Uzzah, who seems to be unaffected by the knowledge that the Aaron is able to hold itself. We see Moshe Rabbeinu, who through a moment of anger forgets something he knew only a moment before, that an Aaron, a Kohen is an Aaron, doesn't need coaching. And we see the Bnei HaNevi'im, the Talmidim of Eliyahu HaNevi, although they knew with absolute clarity only a few hours before that Eliyahu was going to be taken, and how he was going to be taken, and in what way and where he was going to be taken, obviously, the next day they had forgotten it. They acted as if they never knew it. They acted like imbeciles. We can't understand. It doesn't make sense. We read it. We can't understand the behavior of these men. It looks like a comedy. Because the knowledge which we know they have, they're acting as if they don't have. And that's funny when you see people who you know certain things, but they're acting as if they don't know those things, or you assume they know certain things, but they're acting as if they don't. That's funny. When people laugh and it looks very comical. But we need to understand it. The principle that I would like to use to understand all this is the following. Facts don't affect human behavior. The knowledge of facts has no bearing on human conduct at all. Certain knowledge does have bearing on human conduct. The one example that I've often given is the example of the person traveling along the road, driving a little carelessly, the way most of us drive at times, exceeding the speed limit, overtaking where you shouldn't overtake, not quite stopping at stop streets, jumping traffic lights, and all of a sudden he comes across the most terrible accident which has just taken place. and the cold shiver goes through him. He looks there and there's blood and blood splattered all over the road, and then an arm on the one side of the road and a leg on the other side of the road, and dead people all over the place, and ambulances ringing and police all over. And just he can't even look at it. He just has to drive on. He's as white as a sheet. He stops a few yards down the road just to recompose himself and to put himself together. He's seen such a horrific sight, and he goes on driving carefully at about half the speed limit, looking carefully in his mirror all the time, courteously, careful at stop streets, doesn't overtake. What has he learned? Did he learn anything that he didn't know before? What is the experience that has added, that has affected his behavior, which he didn't know before? If you would have asked him 5 minutes before he saw the accident, do you know that driving the way you are could cause a fatal accident? He would say, yes, I know that. I'm fairly careful, it doesn't usually cause a fatal accident. If he were to analyze it statistically, he would have to say, 1 in 10,000 of careless drivers cause fatal accidents. No, I passed the one, so there's another 10,000 to go. So he should say, if he's going to look at it like a cold statistician, he should say the chances are better now. Much easier. Now I can carry on driving carelessly. But he doesn't. He drives very carefully. What's changed? Factual knowledge didn't govern the way he drove. But what he's just seen is not factual knowledge. He's just experienced reality. He's experienced the reality of the consequences of careless driving. And to real things we respond. We don't respond to facts. We respond to reality. And the facts have become real for him. That's all that's happened. If you offer a person a tray of sweets, and he takes a particular sweet, and you say to him, but why didn't you take that sweet there? Look, it looks so delicious. He says, no, I know that one. It's got marzipan inside it. I don't like marzipan. Good. So he's careful. Maybe touch the marzipan. And you say to him, but then I don't understand you, because they're all bad for you. All these sweets are bad for you. Much worse than the marzipan. Marzipan you don't like, but the sweets are actually bad for you. They're not good for your health. So if you're so careful not to eat that which you don't like, why do you eat that which is bad for you? That which we like and don't like is part of the reality. Because we felt it. He's taken a bite into marzipan once and had to spit it out because he doesn't like marzipan. That's real. He knows what it is. But he's never felt the consequences of ill health as a result of eating a sweet. So you can talk to him and you can teach him and you can do all sorts of things. It remains the fact. You say to him, do you know that sweets are not good for you? He'll say, yes, I know. He'll say, we ask you a harder question. I'll be very honest. Do you believe that sweets are bad for you? He'll say, yes, I believe sweets are bad. So why do you eat? Ask anybody who smokes cigarettes. Cigarettes bad for you? Yes. Do you believe they're bad for you? Yes. So why do you say that? That's why it is. And it's a little bit unfortunate that people don't realize that we all do this all the time, and that's why we get undeservedly disappointed when we see, unfortunately, sometimes Talmidei Chachamim, the so-called Talmidei Chachamim, who behave badly. And we think a terrible thing, and if that's what Yiddishkeit is all about, I don't want any of our people sometimes talk. A good excuse. Well, we all do that. One has to understand what's going wrong. It's a serious question. But it's not a reason to become disappointed. What are you saying? He's a Talmid Chachamim, that means he knows the Torah and it doesn't affect his conduct. No, you know the Torah that says sweets are bad for you. Does that mean you stop eating sweets? You know it's bad to smoke cigarettes. Do you stop smoking cigarettes? You don't. So why is it so different with him? He knows Torah and it doesn't affect his behavior either. So there's a certain type of knowledge and information which has no bearing at all, no matter how clearly one knows it. It has no bearing at all on the way we operate. And therefore it doesn't help teaching such a person. Because then you can teach him as much as you want. That's not the problem. Knowledge is not the problem. Why? Because habit is reality. The things he likes is reality. Those are the real things which he relates to. Torah is not real. It's facts, it's knowledge, but it's not real. In the same sense, it's not used, it's not appreciated with the senses. It's not sensual. Torah is intellectual, and intellect doesn't govern the senses.
doesn't do it. All these examples I've given you are proof that the intellect doesn't govern the senses. I could come to you, let's say, I'm assuming that I was highly respected as an aeronautical engineer, world famous and world renowned for my work, and I would show you that if you lay on your back in mid-air and you flap your hands at a certain frequency, and while you were flapping your hands you blew air as fast, as hard as you could, that you could fly, you could actually float in the air and fly. And I showed you clearly and proved it with formulas inside out. And I showed you, I presented a paper in front of all the aeronautical engineers of the world, and you were present. You don't know much about aeronautical engineering, but you saw all the aeronautical engineers were present, and I gave a standing ovation at the end of it. And then I say to you that, okay, so go up to that building there, and you've got to throw yourself back, and remember, blow hard and flap your hands and just see what happens. So, no thank you, sir, no. I say, is there anything wrong with my theory here? Have you gone through my formulas? Anything wrong? No, nothing wrong. Did anybody have a kasha on my theory? No, nobody had a kasha on your theory. Do you not believe me? No, I believe you. No, so go and jump. No, thank you. Not the first thing. Do you know that you're flat? Yes, I know that I'll flat. Do you believe that you're flat? I believe that I'll flat. But I won't do it. Because reality tells me that gravity is going to pull me down. And reality governs my actions, not knowledge. We don't act on the basis of knowledge. That's a very important you say, it's a very disappointing you say, to come to terms with it. It's a very sad thing to come to terms with it. But unless we come to terms with it, we won't begin to understand ourselves. If we don't act on the basis of knowledge, that knowledge does not affect us. And that's why one can teach Torah and teach Torah and teach Torah and carry on being disappointed, and one can give Mr. Shmuel, and one can do anything one wants. And it's not going to affect anybody in the least. That's not going to have the effect. The effect of gravity, that's reality. The formulas on the paper, that's theory. And our actions are governed by reality, not by theory. It's simple as that. No matter how true the theory is, no matter how committed I am to the theory and how much I believe the theory, my actions are going to be governed by reality and not by theory. Let's take Uzzah. So what's wrong with Uzzah? Did Uzzah know the ark would fall? Of course he knew. Did Uzzah know the ark won't fall? Of course he knew. If you would have asked Uzzah a moment before, assuming the animal trips and the cart tilts, would the ark fall off? Uzzah would say, how can you be such an apicurious even to ask such a question? Don't you know an oro naysayeth, naysayeth, if that's no way kosher, what kind of land are you? And a second later, the action can happen and Uzzah puts his hand up. Where's the connection? You just gave a shiur half a minute ago on her own Moses, Moses, and the next minute you're putting your hand up. Uzzah's response to that is, I know gravity. I know when a thing tilts and a thing's falling over, it's going to fall. The theory? That doesn't govern my action. My reflexes are governed by reality. My reflex actions, my responses, I respond to reality, I don't respond to theory. We don't have reflex actions to theoretical knowledge. We have three reflex actions to reality, that's all. So why is Hashem cross of Uzzah? Why did Hashem get so angry with Uzzah? That means it is within human possibility to develop reflex actions. I should be careful how I word this. I was going to say, when it is within human possibility to develop reflex actions to theory. But that's not so. It isn't within human responsibility. But what is within human possibility is to convert theory into reality. And to plug oneself in to theory in the same way as one is plugged into the reality. In other words, the law of Ha'olam Moshe Es Moshe has to be as clear as the law that gravity pulls things down. And just as I respond in a reflex manner to the law of gravity. If I see a person tripping, I rush forward to support them because I know what's going to happen. I know they're not going to stay there suspended in midair. I know they're going to fall. And therefore, my reflex action is to support them. So when an orange slips, I know it will be suspended there in midair, that it will not fall, because I know the law, just as I know the reality of gravity, so I know the reality, not the theory, not the principle, not the yesod, not the sugya of Gemara. I know the reality. That however that's the reality, it's as real to me as the laws of gravity. And if what can be is real to me and is real to me, I will respond to it with the same reflexes that I respond to other reality. In other words, my intuitive responses are going to be attuned to Torah, if Torah would only become real and cease to become theory, or cease to be theory. Then it would affect me. Then I could change. A lovely piece of Gemara, and could somebody bring me a Gemara from Hebron? I'm sorry, I didn't bring it. Thanks, Andrew.
Piece of Gemara in the Lady Shear, where you see an educationalist using this principle. The Gemara in Sanhedrin on that Tzadidalit describes the life in Yehuda in the time of Chizkiyahu HaMelech. Where Yeshayahu gave a Nevuah and said, V'hayor b'yoyim ahu, and it will be on that day during the period of Chizkiyahu, Yosu sivloi mi'al shichmecho, the suffering caused by Ashur, which was the most powerful country at that time, the most powerful country in the world, and it was terrorizing Israel. It had already captured and exiled the 10 tribes, and it was beginning to make the life of Yehuda also miserable. And it will be on that day, it says Yeshayahu Anovi, that the suffering of Ashur will be removed from upon your shoulders. V'ulei me'al tzavorecho, and his yoke from upon your neck. V'chubal oil mitmei shemen, and the yoke will be destroyed in the face of the oil. So there's some oil which Chizkiyahu HaMelech possesses, which is going to destroy the yoke of Ashur. What's the oil? Amar Rabbi Yitzchok Nacho, Shehayo Dolek Bevatei Knesiyos Uvevosei Medroshes. It was the oil of the lamps that burned in the shuls and the Bosei Medrash. That's the lamps, that's the oil which is going to counteract the force of Ashur. Because we have a principle which the Gemara has developed earlier, which Ashur didn't know, but Joseph Yeshayahu says, Hiloi mu'af la'ashem mutzak lo. That posuk means, says Rabbi Lozo Ba'abrechia, Ein nimsar am ayef batiro biyad mi'am etzik lo. A nation who is tired from learning Torah, who is worn out from the efforts of learning, of studying, is not given over to the hands of their enemies. That's the power of limud Torah, of omal Torah, of toil in Torah. And to reinforce again what we learned at the Shalashudas, Frumkeit is not measured by mitzvahs. Mitzvahs are the natural fruit of Talmud Torah. And fruit which is not connected to the tree rots eventually. Mitzvahs which are not the fruit of Torah don't last. They don't have lasting value. Eitz Chaim is the Torah which is the tree. Which is the Torah which is the connection between the fruit and the source of nourishment, which is the earth from which it comes, the water which feeds it. That's the Eitz Chaim. It's the toil of Torah, it's the reward for the toil of Torah which makes Israel unconquerable. Not the Frumkeit. The Frumkeit, the statue is measured in Omar HaTorah, in the degree of Lamdonos, in the degree of learning, of creative learning, of effort of learning, of understanding of Torah. That's where the statue of Am Yisrael is measured. The statue of Am Yisrael is not measured in its Maisa HaMitzvah. The Maisa HaMitzvah is taken for granted. That's something which must be a natural consequence and is a natural consequence of Omar Batoira. Anybody who toils in Torah will do more mitzvah. But the essence of it is to measure how they're learning. And the oil which smites Ashur is the oil that burnt in the Bosei Knesius of Bosei Medrashis. In the shuls and Bosei Medrash, the oils of the lamps that burnt, because there were people there right through the night. There were lamps burning right through the night. That oil was going to save Yehuda from Ashur. How did Chizkiyahu achieve this, asked the Gemara? How did he get to such a stage that there in every shul and every Bosei Medrash the lights burned through the night? No, also what did he do? Noatz Cherev al Pesach Beis HaMedrash. At the entrance to every Beis HaMedrash, Yechizkiyahu HaMelech placed a magnificent, gorgeous, beautiful guillotine. The Omar, and there was a plaque which said, Kol mi she'en ha'isek batiro, yidokir b'cherev zu. Anybody who misses a shir will be guillotined. That's it. There's no please send apologies, no please make it up. Anybody who's not learning will be off with their head. That's it. There's no choice. And then he made a police force, and Bodku Midan Vad Be'esheva. The police went looking for, what did they go looking for? Smugglers. What did they go looking for? People who weren't paying their taxes. They went looking to try and find an Amoritz. They wanted to behead somebody. They were looking for somebody to show an example. Let's find an Amoritz and let's show people what we do to people who are not learning. Veloi motzu Amoritz migevasvad antipres. And they couldn't find a single Amoritz. Imagine Eretz Yisrael without an Amoritz. It's difficult enough to imagine Chutzlaret without an Amoritz, but can you imagine Eretz Yisrael without an Amoritz? What a magnificent place it must have been. Veloi motzu tinuk v'tinukis ish v'ishu shilu yibikim b'yichus tu v'vitar. They didn't find a child, boy or girl, a man or woman who wasn't clear in all the halachas, even of Tumah V'Tahara, the most complex area of Shas. That was Yisrael at the time of Chizkiyahu HaMelech. Again we see, not praised by the Frumkeit. There were other times where there was Frumkeit in Yisrael. That's not the essence. It's not praised because they kept Shabbos and because they kept Kashrus and because they put on tefillin. No, that's not the essence. That comes naturally. That's the overflow. The essence is there was no man, woman or child in Yisrael that wasn't a Bokhi B'Shas. The essence is there was no Amoritz, no Frum Amoratzim and no Fry Amoratzim. Really, there were no Amoratzim. That's what saved Yisrael. Why the sword? Why the guillotine? Good, so put a notice there, issue a government gazette, send out the police. Why the guillotine? Every Beis HaMedrash there has to be a guillotine outside. It's a bit gory. Walk into the Beis HaMedrash every morning and there's a guillotine outside. Talk about Musa. Have you ever seen Musa such as this? Musa is depressing, they say. Mustn't teach Musa. It makes people miserable. Makes people eat. People mustn't be made miserable. But make it all nice and entertaining. Tell them Torah makes you happy. And Torah, they're happy, happy. Tell them, you know, people like it. Happy New Year. Sing a song. You make them sing and feel good. That's Torah. That's not Torah. Torah is anybody who doesn't come to the Beis HaMedrash, off with his head. That's it. Because it is life. Without Torah, there's no life. And had there been Amoratzim in Yehuda, Yehuda would have fallen into the hands of Ashur. That's Musa, to understand that. But not just to understand it in theory. A real guillotine there. It's reality. It's not a nice idea. It's not a Musa concept. It's a real guillotine. And your real head is going to go into that real hole, and that real blade is going to come down and chop it off if you miss a shear. So then miss a shear. That's Musa. That's an understanding of reality. And in this Gemara we have the essence of the understanding of the principle which I've just developed. And that is that when the theory becomes real, then things change. If I were to tell you that it is possible to create a nation where there are no Amalats, I get asked many questions sometimes. People say to me, good, but what about the Jew who is not very intellectual, not very intelligent? Don't you agree that the Litvish Derech of learning before us is not for him? So because people aren't capable of understanding that, I always say it's stuck and not for him. Okay, if he's an idiot, then it's not for him. It's for normal people. If he's a half-wit, it's not for him. No, not a half-wit, they say. If he's not a half-wit, then he can think. If he can think, it is for him. Good, okay. So one leaves that alone. But what would happen if I said to you that one could create a society where there isn't one single Amhoretz? Not in the old age term and not in the nursery school. Not in the soul and seagull and not anywhere else. That there isn't an Amhoretz anywhere. And today, if I would say to you that one could create a society where none of the rabbonim are hamaratzim, people would say, what do you mean? Really? It's possible to do such a thing? Where none of the teachers are hamaratzim. Imagine if we had a society where all Jewish teachers, in all the Jewish day schools, if there were no hamaratzim among them, we would say, what a wonderful society. At last, we've got Jewish education, right? There's a chance for us. But imagine if I said to you, a society where there are no hamaratzim at all. The greengrocer is not an amoritz, and the port is not an amoritz, and the blacksmith is not an amoritz, and the shoemaker is not an amoritz, the rov is not an amoritz, and the sheikhit is not an amoritz, the railway station man is not an amoritz, nobody is an amoritz, the post office man is not an amoritz, even the prime minister is not an amoritz. Imagine such a society. What would you say? That you'd say impossible. And I would say no, it is possible. But there's only one way. Capital punishment for missing a shiur. That's too much. If that's too much, then you're right, you'll never have it. The only way you could possibly achieve it is when people equate Torah with life. Then you can achieve it. Now listen, we all know Torah's life, but Rabbanim tell us all the time Torah's life. We know it's Chaim in the Maghreb, we know Torah's life. We sing all the songs about Torah being...
is this, you know Torah is life, but that's in your theory. And you believe Torah is life. You don't believe it. And then you make the message, you're not going to be finished as well. But that's the thing you know forever. But if there was a guillotine at the door, no help would be stopped. Wouldn't be left. Everybody would be at every share. Nobody would be confused. Nobody would come late. Nobody would leave. The role of Musa since the time of Chizkiyahu HaMelech has been to try and do what Chizkiyahu HaMelech did a little bit more socially acceptable. Because the Bali Musa thought they could get away with that, they would do it also, but people would object, they wouldn't understand. So the role of Musa is to try and make it real in other ways, but it also doesn't help that much unless a whole lot of other things come with it. What about the prophets? Eliyahu's Talmidim? Of course they knew that Eliyahu was going to be taken away, but that was yesterday. Today, they also knew it. If you ask them, do you know what happened to Eliyahu? Yes, he was taken away. By who was he taken away? By Hashem. Was he taken away permanently? Yes. So what do you want to send out a search party for? Because maybe. Do you believe? How do you know he was taken away by Hashem? You say, yesterday we were prophets. And did you have prophecy yesterday? Yes, we did. And what did you know with your prophecy? We knew that Hashem was going to take Eliyahu away forever. You knew that yesterday as a prophet? Yes. And today you want to send out a search party? It's true, we knew that, but maybe he fell off that chariot. Who knows? Maybe. Surely it's our obligation to search. That knowledge that they had yesterday doesn't stand up to the reality of seeing an Eliyahu HaNavi being spirited away in a flimsy, gaseous chariot. Because reality is gravity. Reality is that thing has to fall down sooner or later. That's reality. And if the thing doesn't fall down, he falls off. It runs out of fuel. It's not going to get all the way to Shemayim. It doesn't have any fuel tanks. It can't. The reality is Eliyahu is going to crash. That's the reality. And we must send out a search party. You knew with prophecy that he's not going to crash, that's the theory. And you're right, I know the theory, just as the example I gave you, of you who know my theory, that if you flap your wings at the right frequency, and you blow out air fast while you're lying on your back, that you're going to be able to float in mid-air and in fact propel yourself backwards, and you know it and believe it and accept it, yet you will not throw yourself off the top of the building. So, you can know very well that Eliyahu HaNavi has been taken to Hashem, but at the end of the day, where is he? We find that with our own losses, with mourning. Person knows, person taken away, gone to Hashem, fine.
Yet every now and again and again the heart becomes sore, not just at the loss, that's legitimate mourning, and not just at lost opportunities, all that is legitimate mourning, but at a worrying about the person, where is he, what is he? But you know where he is. But if one forgets every now and again, one misses it every now and again, the knowledge doesn't remain as real at all times as it is when one has it before one. And so the Bnei HaNevi'im had the knowledge and had the facts, but that didn't govern their conduct. The other example I gave in the ladies' shul this morning is an example that one of you gave me on a different subject, but the example is the same. And that's the example of the person who goes to the land show and spends a little bit of time in the funfair part. And he spends, the reason he goes to the funfair part is to learn a bit of Torah. Because one can learn things in the funfair and the Ram show that you can't learn anywhere else. Provided you don't go on the rides, you go to watch. And you watch these crazy machines that turn people upside down and do all sorts of terrible things with them. And you hear people screaming terrible and you don't know what's going on. You want to call a doctor, you want to call the police, you don't know what's happening. Eventually you see that that's how it goes. And you go a little bit closer and you see that it's not that children are being kidnapped and put onto these machines. There's actually a queue. You go up to them and you say, but who's forcing you to stand here? And they say, no, nobody's forcing you to stand. If you want to join, go to the back of the queue. You say, me want to join? What's what I'm going to join for? To go on that thing? They say, yes, of course, we all go. And you say, how much do they pay you? No, you have to pay them, they say. Clearly you don't understand what's going on. My fellow explained to you, see, you buy a ticket and you go back to the queue, eventually you get the chance, you go and that's it. So you don't understand. So you sit down, you pull yourself up a chair and you start thinking, what's going on here? What is happening? They can see that these kids are screaming blue murder and they're paying to go into the same situation. So you figure it out eventually, as one of you did, like you went to this place and thought it all up. And came to the conclusion, no, very simple. They see that they come out alive. So they know it's not dangerous. Once you know it's not dangerous, I can enjoy it. No problem. And you see they're all big guys and they've got their girlfriends there and they're going to show them that there's nothing to be scared of. You can be nice and brave. Off you go. So they have factual knowledge. They have knowledge of the mitzvahs. They have not just factual knowledge, they have knowledge of reality. The reality is, you see all the kids who got on, you see them all coming off again with smiles on their faces. That's the reality. So fine, you watch a little further. And their chance gets to go on, and they're sitting and fine, they're talking to each other, and they're happy as anything, and the thing starts going, and it gets to the top of this massive loop, and they're about to go upside down, and are they yelling and screaming, and they blue in the face, and you take out your binoculars because you came to the rancho to watch people, not to watch things, and you brought binoculars because you knew that was going to be your most important piece of equipment. You take out your binoculars and you watch these kids, and you see they're blue in the face, they're scrunched up, they're terrified. You see their lips moving in prayer to God. You say, my goodness. But they knew it's okay, they knew it's all getting. You shouted for life, you come out alive. What's happened to their knowledge? A moment ago they knew it was all okay. Why are they shouting? The shouting is a reflex action. Reflex against what? Fear of death. But you know you won't die, so why shout? You tell me, you come and give me a shoe, you won't die when you're up here. You won't die. The reality is you will die. That's the reality, and my reflex action is to scream. They come down again and Baruch Hashem, they were saved from death. They come out singing with Chiyas HaMetzim. That's why they're smiling. They come out with a certain superiority. They were feeling something that we haven't, both being on the first for very special people. And then they go and they join the queue again and they open up. But that's a perfect experiment and a perfect picture of the interplay between theoretical knowledge and the knowledge of reality, and they're changing places. One minute this is theoretical and this is reality, and the next minute that's theoretical and that's reality. It just depends on the circumstances. Hizkiyahu HaMelech knew there's only one way, the guillotine. when they see that guillotine there, and if only he can find the number of it. He really wants to find the number of it to show people that the guillotines work. That's what he really wants. But he couldn't find the number of it, so he never used the guillotines. But the reason he couldn't find the number of it is because there were guillotines there. That works. When those kids are up there about to go around the loop, you can make Balei Tshuva of them. You can. You can make Tzadikim of them. They can do Tshuva like nobody else can do Tshuva. Of course, when they're down, it's over. No more Tshuva, back to the old ways, just like we are every Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur, we see it in reality. We stand at Me'ilah and we feel a sword dangling over our heads. We look around us and we feel, Nebuch, there are people who were here last year who are not here this year. And it was at this moment last year it was being decided whether they were going to be here next year or not. We're scared. That's reality. We tremble, we shake, we cry, we appeal to the Rebbeinu Shel. Because we're at that moment, we're on that loop. I mean, everybody comes out of Yom Kippur, very few people dying, and say, well, you can cry, but just crying about it. Not when you're standing there before the Rebbeinu Shel. You're worried. It comes Maariv and you break your fast and the loop is over and you're down on the ground again and it's finished. The realities have changed. Now reality is business again. Now reality is getting the sukkah ready. Now reality is all the things that need to be done. And that sword bangling, that's a nice gemara in Yuma, which you'll learn again next to Elul and Yitzhashe. See? Ceases to be reality. Chizkiyahu kept that sword a reality. It stayed outside every Beis HaMedrash. That sword is real. Not a Gemara in Yuma. That's a decree of the king. And that hole in the guillotine is waiting for some nice Amaratish ahead to go into it and to be chopped off. That's what it was there for, that people will learn from there on that this is not what you do. And so with Moshe Rabbeinu too, although it's very difficult to understand that Chazal, we must say there too, that for a moment Moshe Rabbeinu is disconnected, so to say, from the entirety, from the total perfection of the reality. For if he was connected, the tragedy of forgetting a halacha would outweigh the reflex of getting angry. And the anger wouldn't come, the reflex would not bring to anger. As justified as the anger is, as correct as the anger is, the tragedy of forgetting a halacha would be more real. And that's why he is, so to say, on his level punished for that slight blurring of one area of that reality into which he wasn't fully attuned. So on whatever level we can understand it with Moshe Rabbeinu. There we have a little bit of an understanding of a reflex action and how we can become responsible for our reflex actions. I'll give you another example. If you say to, imagine Chas V'Shalom, Shabbos comes, in the middle of Shabbos, by mistake, you put on a light. And afterwards you say to yourself, there's a non-religious person standing next to you. And you said, I shouldn't have done that. It's Shabbos today. The non-religious person is not going to say, Meshuggah, no, do you? They'll say, oh, okay, you're right, Shabbos, you're not supposed to turn on lights. I understand, you're a religious Jew, I understand, you're feeling upset about it. But imagine the same situation with the same non-religious Jew, you switch on a light by mistake on Shabbos, and oh, say, my goodness, what have I done? Shabbos, what? And you faint. And he goes and he calls doctors and they bring you around and they find that you nearly had a heart attack. He says, well, what happened? He says, I put the light on, it was Shabbos. He says, good, okay, I understand, but it was a mistake. Why did you get such a shock? You've seen something which he couldn't see. You saw an Isra Skila. You saw an Isra Kores. You saw a sugi in Gemara Shabbos. You saw a sword dangling over your head. You saw a Ribbono Shel's face as you did it. You saw yourself having to explain to the Ribbono Shel after 120 years why you neglected to think that moment. That's a reality which you saw before you, and you had a heart attack. It's quite understandable for somebody who sees all that. But somebody who doesn't see it at all, he knows it. You tell him, you say afterwards, you know, Shabbos, very serious, it's a skiller. Could explain to the Rebbeinu Shalom, well, you understand it all, very nice, lovely religion you've got, understand, very nice. No reason to get a heart attack, because he doesn't see it. He has the knowledge and he has the information, but he doesn't have the vision. And unless one visualizes it, unless one sees it, unless it is real, it doesn't help. And you say to him, but my goodness, If you stuck your hand into the fire by mistake, would you be so calm and would you pull it out and say, mistake, you know, I can't be held responsible for this. After all, it was a mistake. How was I to know there was a fire there? Can't be responsible. And carry on. You would yell. Why would you yell? It was only a mistake. You're not being punished for anything so terrible. What do you mean? Stick your hand in the fire and you feel what it's like. Because a fire is real. That's why you yell. If Shabbos is real, you'll yell when you do something wrong on Shabbos. If Lashon Hara is wrong, when a word comes out by mistake, you'll yell, my goodness, what have I done? Have I murdered somebody? Have I killed somebody? And the person who can't see what you've done won't understand what you're excited about. Of course he won't understand. Because he doesn't see. It's not real. It's facts for him. It's knowledge for him. It's information for him. But it's not real. And if it's not real, it doesn't affect. Finally, how do we make it real? There are many mechanisms, and I'll only deal with one or two. And I'm talking on a very low and simple level. I'm not talking about the great tzaddikim of making things real in the sense that I've just described. Just making things a little bit real. Just making basic things real. Number one, one has to attune oneself to a certain routine in order for it to be real. There's such a thing as a routine of a Ben Torah. And one can't feel like a real Ben Torah if one isn't following that routine. Like a routine of a Ben Torah of a Yid, never mind the Ben Torah. You know, let's talk about Ben Torah. A Yid, a routine of a Yid is Shachris Mincha Ma'ariv with a minyan. It's a shir at least once a day. Hazorah with a chavrusa. Tzedokah every day. It's a point of doing a chesed every day. Going over the seder, Chumash Rashi every week. That's basic routine of a Jew. That's not a Ben Torah, that's not a frum Jew we're talking about. We're not talking about a Yerei Shemayim, a Chosid, a Tzadik. We're talking about an ordinary Jew. That's just the basic that he has to do. Shabbos comes in. Shabbos, for example, is a routine which we've gotten used to. It's a routine we do quite well. Every Shabbos comes, we do. Shabbos comes in, we stop doing what we're supposed to stop. We start again afterwards. Shabbos we do right. And Shabbos is real for us. Shabbos is real. We wouldn't skip a Shabbos. Shabbos is real. What's made Shabbos real? The routine. Tied to the routine is the second element, which is unfailing regularity. And again, let me give you an example. If I say to you, in this little bottle there are cyanide tablets. They are poison, deadly poison. If you take one, you die 10 minutes later. And in this other bottle, these are vitamin tablets which you must take every day. But don't touch the bottle of cyanide. And you go and every day you take your vitamin tablet. One day you think, today I'll take the other one. Let's see if it's really cyanide. That means that only theoretical knowledge is not real. If you really know that it's cyanide, you wouldn't do it once. Not once. Because it's poison. Not once. And if I said to you the other way around, a person has a heart disease, I said to you, every day you take this tablet, because if one day you skip, never you can have the most terrible heart attack and you'll be dead. Now if that's just factual knowledge, the doctor shows you and describes to you, you see, you go, one day you skip. You skip that day and you get an attack and you're out and you're in an intensive care unit for 2 months, and they tell you afterwards you came out of it by the skin of your teeth. And that's the last one you're going to come out of. Don't try it again. If you don't miss another day. Come what may, you can be on the other side of the world. You're not going to forget to take your tablets. Every day you're going to take one. If you do skip one, it's not real for you. You don't really understand it. A Yid who skips a Mincha, skips a Ma'ariv, skips a Shachris, it's nice, good, fine, it's not real for him. He believes you're supposed to daven Shachris Mincha Ma'ariv. He's learned the halachas, he knows that the sugi and brochas, he's learned all about it, knows all about it, fine. It's not real for him. A Yid that comes into a Shabbos, to the davening, 5 minutes after Kriyat HaTorah started. Just once he does it. Always there on time. No, once he comes 5 minutes after Kriyat HaTorah, and doesn't flinch, and he walks in quite casually, if it's just Tavis on the stairs. I did miss part of Kriyat HaTorah. Good, I say, no, only once, I don't normally do it. It's not real, it's not terribly serious. Normally he does it, today he didn't do it, so what? No heart attacks, nothing to get excited about. He doesn't see Kriyat HaTorah and the chiyuv of hearing every word of Kriyat HaTorah is not something real to him. It's knowledge, it's facts, he knows the facts, he knows you've got to do it, so I did it today. Good, so what are you going to do to me? Where's the guillotine? Well, at the end of the world. But if there was a guillotine, and if we said, anybody who comes late to Kriyas HaTorah on Shabbos, even if they miss one letter of Kriyas HaTorah, the guillotine is here, and we're not even going to wait until after Shabbos. We're going to do the Maaseh on Shabbos itself, right before the Kiddush, then we'll all come in and celebrate. Nobody will be late. I can imagine what the rest of the town will say about Kriyas HaTorah then. They say enough when all I say is that if you came to a shul, you must be regular. People already say, I'm off my mind. How can you do that to people? Imagine we put a guillotine there like Hizkiyahu HaMelech. We say, you're late, off with your head. Imagine what they would say, but forget about what they would say. It's not important. Imagine we did it. Nobody would be late for Kriyas HaTorah. And you say, I did it for the wrong reasons. They're not late for Kriyas HaTorah because they're scared of the guillotine. Too bad. Let it be for the wrong reasons. But they hear Kriyas HaTorah. That's what's important. It would be for the wrong reasons, doesn't matter. They hear Kriyas HaTorah, it's real for them. If we would really see the importance of hearing every word of Kriyas HaTorah every Shabbos, not only wouldn't we just operate so casually when we walk in and we find Kriyas HaTorah is halfway through already, it just wouldn't happen. If we really understood what Zman Kriyas Shema was and what Zman Tefillah was, we would never miss it. If we really understood, if we really not understood, we do understand. And that's our mistake. We carry on trying to convince ourselves and persuade ourselves and teach ourselves better what it all means. It doesn't help. You can go over Gemara Brachos a million times and it's not going to help. At the end of the day, it needs to become real. And the way it's going to become real is to make a routine of it which is never, ever broken. Because that way you can make something real even if it's imaginary. If you, in your mind, make a circle of a meter in diameter in the middle of the shul, and we tell everybody, don't walk in that, no marks, we will just define where it is, don't walk on that. Everybody walk around that circle. And the years go on and nobody walks over that circle, everybody walks around that circle, nobody walks over it, a stranger walks in and he also doesn't walk in there. And you say, why don't you walk over there? And you say, nobody walks over there. So you say, but why do you think they don't walk over there? I don't know, they say one mustn't walk there. So you're saying, do you think there's any valid reason not to walk there? He says, no, I don't think so. I think it's nonsense. No, so we say, so walk. He says, no. I'd be the first one for. But you believe it's nonsense. Nonsense, I still walk around. You can make reality even out of nonsense. Kol Shechem, that you can make reality out of something real. But if one person walks over that circle and nothing happens to him, gone is the reality. Everybody knows it's Narishkeit there. When one person misses a davening, when one person misses a Krishma, when one person misses a Krishna Torah, it weakens the reality of it, not only for him. It weakens for everybody. You see, it doesn't matter. He came and he's still alive. On the contrary, he missed Kriyas HaTorah this week, and you know what? He made a fortune on the stock exchange than other on Monday. So someone sees there's no connection between the one and the other. And so Torah and Yiddishkeit become less and less real. One knows, if I say to you, do you really think that it's because he missed Kriyas HaTorah that he did well on the stock? Chas v'shalom, I don't think so at all. He'll have to pay one day for missing Kriyas HaTorah. I know that. But the next day he'll not miss Kriyas HaTorah. Why? It's lost some of its fiery urgency. It's not so real. The guillotine has been taken out. That's what's happened. He went, he did it, and he didn't get his head chopped off. So the guillotine is out. Once the guillotine is out, it goes back into the area of technical knowledge, of facts, and not of that kind of knowledge which governs us. That's the area that has to be worked on. The adoption of certain practices, each person in his individual capacity and the community as a community, the adoption of certain practices, and don't start big because it doesn't work. Start with one or two things that you're not keeping fully, and start keeping on the basis of guillotine. No matter what, this I will not miss out on. Not one single day. No matter what I feel like, no matter what's been the night before, no, nothing. This I will not miss out on. Whether it's a shiur one chooses to take that attitude to, or to one's Kriya Shema, or to one's Tefillah B'Tzibur, or to Kriya Satorah, or to an act of Tzedakah, or to a daily act of Chesed, whatever it is. So build oneself up, week after week, each time taking on a little bit more. But on a basis of come what may, no day of my life is going to go past when this is not going to be done. That makes it real. That makes it absolute. That makes it something to which I respond intuitively, not only consciously. The last area which we won't have time to go into is the area of Omar Batoro. I say to you that you can go through the Gemara Brochus 100 times and it won't make you feel any stronger about Kriyas HaTorah, certainly not a year after you finish learning Gemara Brochus. And that is so. But with Omar HaTorah, if there's a creative involvement in the Torah, if there's sweat and toil in it, then it's a little different. If you take a concept and you spend the night on it, and you don't sleep that night, if you take a concept and you work it over and over again until you know it inside out, until it's clear and you remember it and you're creative in it, that does have an effect. That's a different area into which we don't have time to go. Suffice it to say, two areas of knowledge. One area affects our conduct, the other area doesn't. The area that affects our conduct is when it is not knowledge but it is reality. Our tafkid of growth, the only way we grow is to take areas of knowledge and convert them into areas of reality. When we are sure of the emeskat, when we are sure that a value is true, then we need to convert that value into reality. And the way of converting that value into reality is the guillotine method. One has to make one's own guillotine. And one has to ensure that one undertakes step by step more and more actions, mitzvahs, undertakings, values, which not only one says, I'm going to start doing this, but I'm going to start doing this in a way where come what may, I'll never stop. And at no stage in my life will I skip one occasion. When one's able to do that, then one's relating to it as reality, and it begins to affect us. It is then that not only are we masters of our knowledge, but that our knowledge begins to master us, and we become affected both intuitively and instinctively as well as consciously by that which we know and that which we practice.